This is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io. Masters of Dispute Resolution is designed to provide those involved in the mediation process with the views and insights of the most experienced and accomplished mediators in the profession. We'll share the stories of conflict and lessons learned from mediating challenging and intriguing disputes. You'll hear stories about how conflict affected the lives of those involved in the conflict and how resolution of disputes through mediation provided them with the ability to move forward unburdened by an ongoing dispute. Through our discussions, you will gain insight in how to address and overcome difficult issues and achieve more satisfying results in mediation, whether you're a mediator, attorney, or have been or contemplate being involved in mediation. Your host is Len Levy, mediator and arbiter with ADR Services, Inc., a leading alternative dispute resolution provider. Len litigated complex cases for more than 30 years and has been a mediator since 1998, joining ADR Services on its panel of neutrals in 2008. He has been recognized as a super lawyer in alternative dispute resolution beginning in 2014. And now your host, Len Levy.
Thank you, Daryl. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us for Season 5 of Masters of Dispute Resolution, a podcast which will add tools to your mediation toolbox. We're brought to you by ADR Services, Inc. and the American Institute of Mediation. In each podcast episode, and you've heard this for the last few seasons, you're going to hear a story about the conflict that the guest will be discussing, the impact that conflict had on the lives of the parties involved, how resolution was reached, and the lessons to be taken from that conflict and its resolution. Now, many of the details of the story you're about to hear have been modified to preserve the confidentiality, which is essential to mediation, while also conveying the essence of the conflict and its resolution. Today, we're going to be discussing something that may seem like a real easy case, a dog bite, okay? But there's a little bit more to it than this, than the usual dog bite case, and we will be guided through the things that happened that made this a unique situation by Mark Kramer. Mark is a colleague of mine on the ADR Services panel. He is has extensive experience in as both a trial attorney and as a mediator, the combination of two being over 40 years, right? Yes. And Mark is a very, very accomplished mediator and a very accomplished trial attorney who is a member of ABOTA, the American Board of Trial Advocates. He's tried over 50 cases to verdict. He's been involved in cases in a variety of areas, everything from automobile accidents, premises liability, products liability, medical malpractice, construction business, just the list goes on. And Mark is very versatile in handling mediations. His experience as a trial attorney serves him well, and his reputation now has been growing as a mediator. And Mark, thank you very much for agreeing to be on this podcast. And why don't you tell us about the dog bite?
Okay, it's my pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for inviting me, Len. Yes, this case arose out of a dog bite, as Len's already told you. The plaintiff, we'll call him Peter, was visiting from another country with his fiance, and they were celebrating basically with his a friend of his and her boyfriend. She had previously been married, and when she was married, she and her husband had purchased a dog we'll call Rex, who was eventually involved in the dog bite, of course. After dinner, they'd been out to dinner, and at various times throughout the night, apparently, there was some drinking going on. They returned to got to Susan's condo, and there was a dispute as to whether or not there was some warning that the dog wasn't particularly friendly, if you will. But nevertheless, they went into the condominium and perhaps did more drinking, talking, socializing. At some point, Susan's boyfriend was laying on the couch with the dog also on the couch. There isn't any dispute that this is what when this occurred, but exactly what Peter, the plaintiff, was doing was in question. It wasn't clear whether he was leaning over to pet the dog or leaning over to help Susan's boyfriend stand up and get to bed because he apparently had maybe drank a little more than the others, or at least wasn't handling it as well as the others. As he leaned down, the dog suddenly bit him in a very severe fashion. Rex took off part of his upper lip, and the bite and scarring area was approximately 2 inches wide all the way up to his nose, with quite a bit of tissue missing. It's a medical term, but apparently the frenulum of his face or in that area was also gone. Peter was transported by ambulance to one hospital where they, I guess, stabilized him, stopped the bleeding, et cetera, et cetera. They felt the wound was too severe for them to deal with, so he was taken by ambulance to another hospital where he ended up having multiple surgeries. The country that Peter came from had a pretty severe bias against disfigured people, and this bite left him rather disfigured. He had a pretty good job at the time in a professional capacity, if you will, and he ended up losing that job. It was unclear, and I think it probably remains unclear, whether he lost that job because of the time he had to remain in the United States before he could return home and had missed time from work, or whether he lost the job because of the disfigurement. However, because of the disfigurement, he was finding some low-paying jobs, nothing close to his, but had apparently, or was said to have applied for over 500 positions in a higher caliber, such as he had before this incident, but had not been able to find one, but was working in a variety of low-paying jobs. So that was another part of it.
Okay, so let me try to get a picture here, Mark. The dog is how big?
He was about 70 pounds.
Okay, so a 70-pound dog, and it severely, I mean, disfigured this guy.
That's correct. The pictures were not pretty, shall we say.
Okay, so it's and obviously he has a major effect on his life, aside from having to go to a lot of doctors, right?
It did. He is left still with a scar that the actual incident occurred a couple of years before the mediation, of course. And there was a possibility he was going to have a further surgery. I think that was one thing that he needed money for it. And it's not clear how what he's going to be left with, if no matter how many surgeries he has from plastic surgeons. He also says he has nerve pain. That's almost a constant thing as a result of this in his face. And I think it's not clear if it's getting better. He's just getting used to it. But he still is bothered by that.
Got it. And so now this particular dog was owned by Suze?
Well, that ended up being a very big issue, if not the main issue, in trying to get this case resolved. Who owned the dog? The dog had originally been purchased by Susan and her then husband, and where they lived in a prior city. That in the prior, let's just say this dog, if you watch enough police shows, he had a prior because he had bitten someone else in the prior city when they were still married and was labeled by that city or registered in that city as a potentially dangerous animal. One issue as to who owned the dog at this time after the divorce, and I think I may have mentioned that the divorce decree or documentation coming out of the divorce was silent as to the ownership of Rex, the dog. Mike, her husband, her ex-husband, when they moved to the new city, he registered the dog as a potentially dangerous animal in the new city with his name and his wife, then wife's name as co-owners. Sometime subsequent to that, Susan had him chipped with perhaps because they moved, but on that one, it was only her name. It appeared that Mike was not contributing to the upkeep of the dog, if you will, the feeding, the grooming, the vet visits, whatever they have. But there was some issue as to that, whether that was involved and who owned the dog. Plaintiff's counsel was arguing about there being, since the dog wasn't mentioned in the divorce papers, it was a, they were both tenants in common with respect to the dog. And this issue would really drive a lot of the negotiations, as I'll get into perhaps.
So a lot of this is, no, it's not my dog. Not my dog. So that's going to, if I could just be just a little presumptive here, that's going to affect something like insurance?
Very much so. I can get into the actual lawsuit, what was going on. But Susan, let me just say that Susan did not have insurance. Mike's family had insurance. And sometime after their divorce, he was living with his parents with, and at some point in time during, apparently during their marriage, the parents had taken care of Rex for a while. They had a policy. Susan had no insurance policy, but Mike's parents did. That clearly covered Mike. But of course, as you'll learn, that insurance company was saying, well, Mike didn't own the dog. We've got nothing to do with this.
Wow. Okay. So this is now set up with, you know, one thing that's clear, we've got clear injuries, right?
Indisputable.
And nobody's arguing really the extent of the damages that are being incurred, or?
There was some, some discussion of that in the mediation as to, how much these potential future surgeries would help, or whether they'd help, or if it'd be worth it, a variety of things like that. But in reality, the defense wasn't really, it wasn't one focused at all on how the injuries were, because there wasn't a whole lot of room to claim that they weren't that significant, if you will. Sometimes you can say, oh, they should have been over that by now. They, you know, their back shouldn't still be hurting. But in this one, there was really no dispute that he had a significant injury.
We'll get into the mediation and that mediation session when we get back. So right now, we're going to be taking a break. This is Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and I'm chatting with Mark Kramer.
Masters of Dispute Resolution would like to thank ADR Services Incorporated, your partner in resolution, and its founder, Lucy Barron, for supporting this podcast. ADR Services is one of the leading providers of alternative dispute resolution in California. Leveraging technology to drive resolution, ADR Services is committed to dynamism in the face of growing client need and an ever-evolving legal climate. Now operating offices in all major legal markets of California, ADR Services provides unparalleled in-person and remote resolution services through its exclusive panel, comprised of more than 130 of the most distinguished and talented neutrals across the state, capable of handling challenging and complex mediations, arbitrations, and other procedures in every field of law. When you seek the services of a neutral and you want results and satisfied clients, contact ADR Services, www.adrservices.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and Mark Kramer is our guest, who is explaining the impediments of resolving a case involving a very severe dog bite incident. And I think we're going to be talking now about what happened in the mediation and what allegations were set out going into that session.
Okay. Well, Peter, obviously through his counsel, sued Susan and Mike, the formerly married couple. He also sued her boyfriend. I'm saying, Susan's new boyfriend, Steve, we'll call him, as well as Mike's parents, Sally and Tom, as Mike had lived with his parents for a while with the dog at some point in time. And as we know, as I've already mentioned, I think the divorce decree was not, had no comments on who owned Rex. Peter had two attorneys. Susan had counsel, but no insurance. Mike and his parents had insurance retained counsel, and Mike also had a personal attorney. for this. And Steve did not appear, and no one really seemed to care that he wasn't there. And I don't believe that he had any insurance that would have covered this, which is probably why no one cared if he appeared or not. The mediation started, as so many do, with the plaintiff making a demand, which was many multiples of the potentially available insurance, and with the defense team, particularly the insurance carrier through their counsel, to the insurance retaining counsel, making a pretty de minimis offers. Both sides with the insurance company, if you will, saying that the demand was a non-starter, basically. And in the other room, I was getting that the offers were non-starters, et cetera, et cetera. It took quite a while to get people moving, but they were only willing to move so far because of what would turn out to, in terms of getting this case resolved, to be the biggest issue, once again, who owned the dog. And that was because the insurance company, while making a de minimis, if you will, offer, or a relatively small offer in the context of this case, was taking the position that their insured, Mike, had no ownership interest in the dog at the time and really wasn't even a proper defendant. And they were going to make a motion for summary judgment with as to his parents, which would probably be granted and may well have been granted before this case was resolved, but that wasn't a big issue. The question was whether Mike was an owner or had any ownership interest in Rex, the dog, at the time of the bite.
And I assume that Susan had no money to speak of, and neither did the absent boyfriend. For whatever reason, he was sued. Unless he was egging the dog on or something like that.
Right. There was no claim that he was egging the dog on. It was a question about whether he was asleep or passed out from drinking or whatever at the time of the bite. I'm sure he had no insurance because no one even brought that up and no one cared that he wasn't present at the mediation. Hmm. Susan did not have any insurance, had requested that she would be, requested coverage, if you will, from the insurance company for Mike and his parents, who denied coverage. Plaintiff's counsel was taking up a laboring oar, saying that, there was bad faith right there. They should be covering her. They should be extending coverage, et cetera, et cetera. Mike had personal counsel as well, and he also wanted her covered just to try to get the case resolved, if you will. But the insurance company, and this just a whole lot of discussions throughout this and post-mediation before we get the case resolved about who owned the dog and various factors involved in that. That was the main issue. The insurance company, as I say, while making an offer, was not making an offer that they even thought would be appropriate for the injury, mm-hmm. but based upon their feeling that, hey, we don't really even have anything to do with this case. Our insured did not own the dog at the time. The parents had nothing to do with this. And, we're just making a small token offer, if you will, to try to get out of here.
This presents something that we see as mediators very, very often. The claims that are made that, there's just nothing there, on the defense side. And yet somehow you're able to get these parties together in terms of resolution. So the who owned the dog aspect, how did you approach resolution of this case?
Well, there are two things. There obviously the plaintiffs, as I say, had started something in multiples, many multiples of the potential insurance involved. And they were, of course, I was hearing a lot about the quote unquote, as we all often hear in mediation, the cap is off the policy, mm-hmm. which of course is never a certainty. I don't know that either side could ever be sure. The insurance company can't be sure, well, it's not, or the defense, the plaintiff side, can't always say, yeah, for sure it is off. It's not exactly black and white on that usually.
Well, let me interject just to clarify for folks. When we're talking about the cap is off the policy, we're talking about a policy limit and then a demand within the policy limit, which is refused by the insurance company, and the claim being by the plaintiff, well, now there's no limit because you've refused a demand within policy limits. Sometimes very complex analysis needs to take place before any conclusion could be made on whether that's true.
You're certainly correct there. And that was something that had to be discussed in each room. I should say repeatedly. Maybe I shouldn't say repeatedly, but that came up quite often in both rooms, if you will. We actually had, I think, four rooms, but came up in several of the rooms. Let me just say the plaintiff's counsel room and the room for the insurance carrier and the insurance retained counsel. That was something that was discussed a lot. The other, you know, factors were, of course, the carrier wanting to stay in the rather low range because they felt they had nothing to do with this. And in that room, we had to be talking about their potential exposure in addition to the cap off the policy. But if in fact a jury believed that their insured Mike did in fact own the dog or have an ownership interest in the dog on the day of the accident. So that was something that was discussed repeatedly in various facets and various facets of the mediation.
You know, in terms of the arguments that are being made, you know, the caps off the policy, this is really your insured. What resonated with the carrier ultimately to take maybe our exposure is more than just de minimis?
Well, let me say that during the course of the mediation itself, they were doing a good job of saying nothing was resonating in that regard, if you will. They did move in a smaller case, you'd say they moved substantially, but in view of the injury in this case, they didn't, during the course of the actual mediation, they didn't move that much. Eventually, and I will say through a lot of follow-up, was able to get the case resolved. And I think that two things did ultimately, two factors, if you will, get them moving into a more appropriate range to try to get the matter resolved. And that was one, the potential exposure based upon the severity of the injury. So that was something that I think had to concern them. The other thing is, you know, that obviously a jury, there were so many different factors as to who owned the dog that it was possible that a jury might conclude, in fact, that Mike was an owner of the dog or, you know, a partial owner. He wasn't, no one would have claimed that he was the sole owner, but that he was one of the owners of the dog on the day of the incident. The case, this it somewhat moved slowly. I made an awful lot of follow-up calls to get this matter resolved. And I don't think I ever had before, but I actually, in preparation for this discussion, counted in it. I made 37 follow-up calls to get this matter resolved. And eventually we did get it resolved with the plaintiff receiving the policy limits plus some med pay and a much smaller contribution from Susan, a personal contribution from her as she had no insurance.
We're going to get into a little bit more of that in a bit. But in the course of the first mediation session, what you're trying to do is you're trying to keep the parties talking and keep the parties moving however slowly they're moving. So there had to be something that was driving that. And I think you pointed out two things. One is the potential exposure in combination with the severity of the injury. The major injury being a real driving factor here. So that's one of them. But let me focus on the second one for a second. And that is the jury might conclude that Mike is a partial owner. So you have Mike who is, and it seems to me, and I'm actually asking the question really, is it the factual possibilities they could find, well, wait a minute, Mike, you knew that this dog was a dangerous dog. You registered this dog. And then you still had Susan doing it. You didn't do anything to protect yourself and maybe make it more known so that you or you didn't have somebody who owns a dog that you know is dangerous. And you're not going to do anything further than just give it to her in the divorce decree?
That's correct. There was no allegation by anyone that he had taken any of those steps. No one really talked about that. You know, the big thing was that he had registered the dog with his name on it as the potentially dangerous animal. That was a big factor. And that the divorce documentation was silent on that. You know, and the insurance company, retained counsel, kept talking about the fact that she'd had the dog put down after this incident without consulting with Mike. Although I'm pretty sure, given the severity of that, it was not a questionable decision, perhaps on her part. I don't remember it coming up and how immediate that reaction was, but I gathered it was pretty quickly because there was probably quite a bit of blood in her condo and she was probably pretty concerned, I think.
Right. We're going to take a break. And when we get back, we'll get into some of the lessons that we can learn from this, and perhaps even starting out with the idea of the factual context of what's going on here. A dangerous animal, knowledge by a person, and a severe injury. We'll talk about how that may have driven the settlement. When we get back to Masters of Dispute Resolution, I'm Len Levy, and we're speaking with Mark Kramer.
Hi there. We hope you're enjoying another fascinating episode of Masters of Dispute Resolution. Has the show ever made you think about becoming a mediator and doing the work you're hearing these experts doing? Are you thinking about it right now? Imagine a career where you're working to help people in conflict find win-win solutions. The sense of purpose you'll feel can easily be heard in the voices of the guests on this show and its host, expert mediator Len Levy. Or maybe you're a mediator already looking to build your skill set in order to pull off some of the brilliant and out-of-the-box solutions that these guests are talking about. That's where we come in. We're the American Institute of Mediation, and we train mediators of all levels. We're the place you come to learn the basics of mediation or to raise your game in the field. We specialize in mediating commercial and litigated cases, but we teach the skills in such a way that will work in any setting. Our slogan is world-class training for the complete mediator because we feature the world's best mediation trainers and we prepare you for all aspects of being a professional mediator. Find us online at AmericanInstituteOfMediation.com and browse all of our courses that are available for streaming on demand. You can watch our courses at your convenience, at your desk, on a plane, or in bed in your jammies. We'll see you in the mediation world soon.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and Mark Kramer is explaining how he wrapped up a case where nobody seemed to want to even admit ownership of a dog, much less having any exposure to liability here. But you know, when we broke, one of the things that just it occurred to me is, how many cases are really fact-driven? And in this particular case, the facts are horrendous in terms of known, undisputed facts. Severe injury, severe in terms of life-changing kinds of injuries. Some questions about insurance coverage. How did the facts drive this resolution, Mark?
Well, I think the facts, a lot of which weren't in dispute, but you know, there was, I guess it was in this case, the dispute initially when we began the mediation, and that one side thought that the divorce papers and documentation did in fact discuss the ownership, if you will, of Rex, the dog. It turned out it didn't, and we were able to get that clarified relatively early in the mediation. And I think that may have driven the defense side to have the position that they came in and stayed with really throughout the mediation and through quite a bit of the post mediation follow-up that I was doing, that their client, their insured, if you will, did not own the dog and had no ownership interest. But those facts were critically important to this case. And all the other facts, which seemed undeniable, but a lot of it was more what were the effect of those facts. And I'm talking about Susan having the microchip with just her name on it for Rex the dog, the fact that Mike had, and that wasn't wasn't a discussion as to whether or not he'd done it, but in fact that he had his name on the dog when he registered in the new city as a potentially dangerous animal. You know, less important facts were that the dog Rex had spent some time with Mike's parents and Mike at their home. That wasn't in dispute, but that really didn't factor into it. It was just a question who owned the dog, and we were hearing many different legal theories about the effect of each fact. But ultimately, was what was driving the settlement, since there was really only one significant pot of money here, and that was from the insurance policy for Mike and his parents.
Well, let me just interject one other thing, Mark. You did a lot of defense work when you were a trial attorney, I know, and one of the things that it seems people have a tendency to overlook is just how important it is for accurate facts to be provided to an insurer so that they can consider those going into a mediation. And conversely, the effect of misstating facts to an insurer. Can you comment on that?
Well, it's absolutely critical. And in this case, I think probably the position that the insurance company began with and really stayed with throughout the mediation had probably been driven to a large extent by the belief, a mistaken belief, a belief that the divorce documentation set forth who owned Rex and that it wasn't their insured. So while there are other factors that they were considering, and perhaps that's why they were making any offers at the beginning, I think that had to have had a significant effect on their very strong position they stayed with for a while that, hey, it wasn't our insured's dog and we've got really no reason to be here and we got no reason to pay much more than we're offering now. I will say they did start in, I probably wasn't quite even cost of defense is where they began. In fact, I'm sure it wasn't cost of defense. It was below that. And we may have gotten them in the mediation itself closer to, but really still not even full cost of defense, I don't believe. Eventually, they did agree to pay their policy limits based upon, the factors we've discussed, such as the potential exposure, if in fact a jury found that Mike was an owner, whatever share of ownership he had at the time of the bite.
The carrier was still willing to talk with you.
Right.
And you were... You know, you're nothing if not tenacious here, Mark. I got to tell you, how many phone calls did you have to make to get this thing resolved?
I wouldn't have thought it was that many, but I counted. It was 37 post-mediation calls to follow up and get it resolved.
And 37 calls to get the insurance carrier to move from not even close to cost of defense to policy limits plus.
Right. Well, policy limits plus the med pay, and then Susan made a contribution. I should say also, it was not all on them. I was also going to get plaintiff down to, because the mediation itself ended with them saying they would, if they offered the policy limits now, we won't take them. And they were staying at a multiples of the policy limits, which, given that the available policy limits, it would seem perhaps ridiculous, but they had their argument that the cap was off the policy. In terms of the context of the injury itself, their initial demand, which was multiples of the policy limits, was not ridiculous for the injury, perhaps, but what was available made it a non-starter for the insurance company, if you will.
So the insurance company representative has to justify making a recommendation for paying whatever amount, okay? And that justification has to be based on a real assessment of exposure, correct? Yeah. How the policy limits cap being taken off impacted versus some other argument. Do you have any sense as to what resonated with the insurance company in this case?
I think what resonated, really was the possibility, and they certainly couldn't say it was zero. I couldn't put an exact percentage that, in fact, a jury, based upon the various factors which we've talked about, would conclude that Mike had some ownership interest in the dog, whether it be 50%, which would probably have been the most likely if the jury made that determination, or maybe it'd be down to 40% because Susan had possession at the time of the bite. So I think that was a major factor. The other was, if they conclude that, a verdict would likely be in excess of the policy limits due to the severity of the injury. And I think that those two factors certainly ultimately resonated, if you will, with the carrier and made it possible to get the case resolved.
Now, was there anything that the plaintiff's attorney could have done or should have done that might have resulted in either a settlement without 37 phone calls, or was this one of those that you needed to have play out?
I think really we probably need to have it play out to some extent, because if, as I said, at the end of the mediation, plaintiff's counsel were at the position that even if they were offered us the policy limits now, we wouldn't take it. So on the one hand, I could say, yes, if they had come down to something instead of multiples of the policy limits, getting something, you know, much closer to the policy limits, I don't know that it would have mattered at that point, because the carrier throughout the mediation was still strongly entrenched in their position that, hey, we really don't owe anything here. It wasn't our insured's dog. So while it may have, it would have gotten them, perhaps if they came to down to the policy limits at the mediation, the insurance company may have started negotiating closer to the policy limits. They were well below 20% of the policy limits, if you will, in their offers.
Got it.
And they may have come up somewhat, but I don't think they would have approached the policy limits at that time. And certainly plaintiff's counsel was taking this very strong, hard line that we won't take the policy limits, which eventually they did, of course. I don't think the two sides were willing to move yet enough to get it done without the carrier getting more concerned, if you will, as to their position in this case.
Could you comment on whether you were close enough to consider doing bracketing or some other technique, or did you use bracketing?
It didn't seem to work. You know, it wasn't very effective in this case because they were so far apart that, you know, you often look at what the midpoint of the brackets are, as you know, and wouldn't have made sense for either side, really. It didn't, that didn't go anywhere at all.
And
sometimes that's helpful, but
look, a recognition on your part that there is an appropriate time to bracket, or at least to suggest doing a bracket. Sometimes you get carriers who are, and plaintiffs who are, just very hesitant to even offer any sort of bracket. But you can't just throw brackets out there, right?
Absolutely. I mean, in this case, you know, a bracket any bracket the plaintiff would have proposed or agreed to would have a midpoint that was significantly above the policy limits, would have been a non-starter, the carrier in this case. So I think there was some discussion of it, but it was pretty quickly agreed it wasn't going to be effective in this matter, because any bracket the carrier proposed would have been significantly below the policy limits, which was a non-starter in the plaintiff room.
Yeah, I don't want to get into a whole discussion of what brackets are, but just for those who might not be familiar, a bracket is a conditional offer. I'll move to this particular number if you move to that particular number. And so it gives you a bargaining range, and very often a bargaining range proposed by one side is countered by a bargaining range proposed by another side. And there are things that can be done with bracketing, and we just don't have the time to do it in the next 30 seconds about bracketing. But there's also something that has been that mediators use, and it seems like more and more these days is a mediator's proposal. Did that ever come into play here?
I recall that we did discuss that briefly, but I my practice with Meteor's proposal, and I've actually had only one or two perhaps that weren't accepted by both sides, but I like to vet them, if you will, and I'll tell people I'm not doing it on an evaluative basis. I'm not going to tell you that this case is worth exactly X dollars or it's worth Y dollars and this is where you folks should settle, but I try to come up with a bracket that I think is the highest amount the defense side will pay and the lowest amount the plaintiff or plaintiffs will accept to try to resolve it in that manner. And I don't do a Meteor's proposal unless both sides want both or however many sides there are do want the Meteor's proposal and they understand what I'm doing, not on an evaluative basis, but what the best chance of getting the case resolved would be.
And in this case, you came to the conclusion that making a mediator's proposal was not going to be a useful tool or necessary to get it resolved.
Yeah, I did not believe it was useful based upon the somewhat intransigent, if you will, positions or neighborhoods, I should put it, that they were both operating in. They were so far apart that it wasn't one. They weren't in the frame of mind, if you will, yet where they would have considered anything that would have been palatable to the other side, if that makes any sense.
Well, Mark, we have reached the end of this session, and I thank you very, very much for your insights and wisdom on how tenacity combined with experience and knowledge will get people into a position of resolving a case that's causing them some grief during the time prior to resolution. So thank you. And as we wrap up, let me ask you, if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way of doing it?
You can reach me online or my cell phone number is 310-490-5493, or you can call my case manager, Evie, at ADR Services, I think 310-201-0010, or ADRservices.com. You can find us that way. Thank you very much, Lynn.
Mark, thank you so much for this conversation. I really, really hope we have you back again as a guest in the future. And thank you, Daryl Wayne, my engineer and producer. I'm your host, Len Levy, and this is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, powered by Infogen Labs, Inc. I hope you will enjoy the stories we bring you. And in the meantime, stay well, keep listening, and remember, peace of mind is enhanced when conflicts are resolved.
If you wish to contact Len Levy, you can reach him through his email at lslevy@adrservices.com, through Len's website, lenlevymediate.com, telephone him at 818-903-5562, or contact his case manager at ADR Services, 213-683-1600.